that writer. Every day I wake up and decide I need to get a regular job. Every single day. Every day. I don't miss a day. I don't even give Sunday a break. You know what I'm saying?
What's good? I'm Nikisha Elise Williams, and this is Black and Published, bringing you the journeys of writers, poets, playwrights, and storytellers of all kinds. Today's guest is Rhonda McKnight, author of the novel, The Thing About Home. The book marks Rhonda's return to traditional publishing after a 10-year hiatus when her former imprint folded.
It was kind of like a box that I had checked off. I always wanted to write a book. I've walked into Barnes and Nobles. I've walked into Walmart. I've picked it up. I've got the pictures. It's in the library. I'm done with this. Totally done with it. And so one of my writer friends said, girl, you can't stop writing.
And she didn't. Instead of quitting like she had planned, Rhonda pivoted and began self-publishing romance. Now, with nearly 24 indie titles to her name, she explains how breaking her own rules helped renew and revive her literary career. Plus, the missteps she took toward making a life as a writer before committing to the craft. And how she balances writing serious literature with the escapism of romance while never leaving out the beauty of Black history. That and more is next when Black and Published continues. So let's jump in. And since you've been listening, you know, when did you know that you were a writer?
I had always written from the time I was 6. I wrote my first book when I was 6 years old about a family of mice that lived under the boardwalk in the town that I grew up in Asbury Park, New Jersey. It was mostly illustrations at that point. And so I started writing then. And then I wrote all through high school. Whenever there was an opportunity to write, I was the editor of my school newspaper. There were essay contests and things that I signed up for. But I think I kind of always thought it was interesting. I thought everyone could write, but I just chose to do it publicly. Mm-hmm. I didn't realize that it was a gift until I was in college and a professor said to me, this is a gift. If you put some more work into this, you might be able to get this published. And I'm like, what are you talking about? Like, what? You know? And so it was at that point that I realized, I think I always wrote, but I don't think I realized I was a writer until someone pointed it out to me.
Wow. So then once it was pointed out to you that it was something that you could do for a career, where did that journey take you? And where did that thought, that light bulb moment, how did that play out?
Once he made that statement, I still struggled a lot with the idea of becoming a writer. First of all, I was at the Fashion Institute of Technology in New York City. I was studying textile science. And so I was on this path to being in the fashion industry. And so I just sort of put it in the back of my mind, continued along my way. And then in the early 90s, I got a hold of one of Terry McMillan's books. And I think it was Mama. And I thought, wow, I used to write books. I used to try to write a book. I can do this. And so I started trying to write. And I remember telling my husband, you know, I think if I had a computer, I would write a book. And this was when computers were really expensive. And so he was like, oh, you can write a book. He started working overtime, saved up, got me this computer. Cause like I said, they were expensive back then. And then I got the computer. I sat down. I wasn't writing anything, wasn't getting anywhere. I said, you know, I think if I had a better desk, I probably would write a book. And so we got me a, you know, really nice desk, just laid out, you know. Still wasn't writing anything. I said, you know, I think if I had a better chair. And so then I got to a point where I realized the issue really wasn't that I needed a better anything. I needed to be better on the inside. I needed to be committed to this process. So we moved from New Jersey to Atlanta, Georgia. And the first thing I did, literally, like we were there, we moved on a Wednesday. And on Saturday, I went to a writers group meeting that I learned about when I was in New Jersey. I was prepared, like, I'm going to this meeting. I don't care how many boxes, whatever. And there were authors that I had been reading, romance authors, but they were Black romance authors. And that was a new thing, you know? And they were at this meeting and I couldn't wait because I was going to meet these people that I'd been reading. I was so excited. So I went to the meeting, I joined the group, and there began like the journey to actually learn how to craft a story. I learned very quickly. The reason you can't move past 7 chapters is because you don't have a plot, girl. All you got is some people talking. So I had to study.
That is awesome. I love, though, how you were getting your space prepared for when you would eventually write. In the study and making the commitment to do this thing that you had always done, what did you learn about yourself and the craft of writing?
You know, I learned something that I tell people all the time, that the desire to write or writing itself can be a gift. But crafting a story is a process, and we need to respect it. Just because you have a gift to write doesn't mean you need to sit down and write a book. We need to study good books. We need to get an understanding of character and theme and what all those things mean. Respect it. You know, you don't have people in a symphony that just show up with an instrument they haven't rehearsed. You know, I think it's the same thing with writing. I've studied enough to at least feel like I'm trying to put the best stories in the world that I can.
I like that. It made me think of when you have prodigies like a Misty Copeland or these, you know, concert pianist prodigies, even though they're prodigies, they have this exceptional gift. They still have to practice and they still have to work at it. You said you have a master's in education, but you didn't go back to get an MFA, did you?
No.
So then your study has purely been reading and working in your writing group. Can you talk about how that, I don't want to call it unconventional because having an MFA is a bit elitist, but can you talk about how, I guess, maybe this non-traditional path of studying the craft of writing has helped you as you began your career?
It's given me the time to do it on my own schedule. I wrote over a long time. You know, I joined that writers group in 1998 and attended meetings for several years. And then in 2002, just sort of thought, okay, you can go into meetings. You're still just getting down, you know, a couple of pages here and there. You're not really moving forward. Prayed about it like, God, like, what is my purpose? Am I supposed to be doing this writing thing or am I supposed to be advancing in my career, which was moving very well for me? But I just didn't feel like that was like, this is not my gift doing this job. I'm good at it, but it's not my gift. And so I asked him for help. And literally, like hours later, I opened an email and I had an invitation to come and visit a critique group. I put out on the internet that I was in this group, that I was interested in being in a critique group. I couldn't find one. And this woman said, well, we're meeting, we're closed, but you can come observe us and then maybe you can find some people and you guys can duplicate our model. So I went to that meeting. It was a group of 9 women and I fell in love with all of them instantly. And I was like, I am not leaving. You guys have to let me. And we laugh about it now, but I literally stood in front of the 2 people who organized the group and said, please, please let me join your group. Like, don't tell me I can't be a part of this group. Can you imagine? Like, so put them on the spot. And so they were like, what is this girl? You know? And so they allowed me to join and we studied together. It was like iron sharpening iron. You know, we would send chapters to each other every week and we would read and we would correct each other. But the correction was all in love. It was always like, no, we are going to put good books out in the world. And there were 10 of us. And out of the 10 of us, 5 of us ended up eventually being traditionally published in a very short time. So it was a good season. And so that really, that experience of just sort of workshopping my work with people who loved me and being committed and having that strong work ethic over that time is what really, MFA wasn't going to give me that. You know, there was the love. Like, I want you, my sister, I want to see you succeed. And what I'm saying to you is in love always and prayerfully, you know? And so that was a beautiful thing.
What was the time frame? You said you started wanting to join the group in what was 98, mid-2000s, you found this other group. When did your first book come out?
I started writing my first book in 2004, like found a concept that I wanted to write. I finished it in 2007 with a lot of, you know, a year of it sitting on the dining room table in pieces. I got a contract, I believe it was at the end of 2007. Yes. And it took 2 years for the book to come out from Urban Christian was the imprint. So it came out in December of 2009.
So what has your publishing process been like going through that whole long journey from 2004 to 2009 and now 10 some odd years later?
Right. So my first book came out and it took 2 years to come out. The second one came out 7 months later, An Inconvenient Friend, which actually happened to be a bigger book for me. December is a kind of a horrible month for a new fiction writer to release a book that's not about Christmas. And I kind of knew that, but I was stuck. You know, with traditional publishing, there are advantages and disadvantages. And one of the disadvantages is that they have the say over certain things. So I wasn't really happy about my release month, but the book still released fairly strong for a new writer. But then my second novel, An Inconvenient Friend, just was everywhere. The distribution was amazing. It sold a lot of copies. It did really well. I gained a pretty solid readership. The next book that released in that series, that was 2010, came out in 2012. It also did fairly well. But then borders closed. And when borders closed, it was like, bam, it was like being slammed in the back. You know, we lost our distribution funnel, you know, as Black writers. Borders was there for us. And so our imprint eventually, a year later, went away. And so I decided, okay, well, this writing thing was cool, but I'll move on. I've accomplished that goal. I've published a book. There's
really
not much. Yeah, there's not much to this. There's not a whole lot of money or fame or any of those things. Not that I was looking for those things, but it was kind of like a box that I had checked off. I always wanted to write a book. I've walked into Barnes and Nobles. I've walked into Walmart. I've picked it up. I've got the pictures. It's in the library. I'm done with this. Totally done with it. And so one of my writer friends, Sherry Lewis from that original group, said, girl, you can't stop writing. Now, mind you, she had stopped writing.
Not the friend that stops writing and say, girl, you can't do what I did.
She said, you can't. Yeah, I did, but you can't. So I was just, yeah, actually, I can. I'm like super busy with my life. And so she said, I want you to do one thing. She said, I want you to write a story, something that is fun and different. Just write something fun that you enjoy. Not that I had not enjoyed writing the novels I've written before, but they were the subject matter was kind of serious, you know. She said, do something fun. So I wrote a novella in 2 weeks. A romance called Breaking All the Rules. And I hadn't written romance before, but I had been reading. I'd always read romance. I love romance. And so I wrote it and I thought, oh, I can't publish this. Like, I can't put this in the world. Like, my readers are expecting a certain type of book from me. So everyone was self-publishing at this point. And I decided, maybe I'll give it a try. So got it edited, got a great cover, self-published it. And it would not stop selling. It still has not stopped selling. It would not stop selling. And I tell people that book was the book that saved my writing career. It, breaking all the rules, I broke my own rules, you know, and did something different. And it just was, it was a beautiful thing. And then I thought, oh, okay, I can do this thing myself. So from there, I wrote another 20 indie stories. Mostly romance. Yeah, another 20 between, I mean, I just published one a month ago, you know, and so I wrote another 20 stories and they've always sold well. I've always had really good reviews. My readers, I love them. They support me fully. They've just made this so beautiful. And then I decided back in 2020, during the pandemic, you know, when everything was happening with George Floyd and publishers became very aware that they were about to catch the wrath of Twitter. And so all of a sudden they were looking for melanated books. Let me go deeper. They were looking for melanated people to write the melanated books. How about that?
Yeah.
So, because we had had a lot of that, them people writing books and stories that, you know, they perhaps shouldn't have been trying to tell. And so I decided, you know, maybe it's time to step back into traditional publishing. You know, I had been away from it. I enjoyed being indie. I was on my own schedule. I could write the story the way I want, however long or short. And so I decided, let me give this a try. And so I went to a couple of writers' conferences and started pitching this particular story.
Wow. I was not expecting that from this journey that you have. Not at all. So aside from the few books that came out 2009 and 2012, you've been just doing it on your own with the strength of your own readership and your own name.
Right. And look, and trying to learn how to use Amazon and Facebook ads. Yeah, that's it. That's what I've been doing.
Wow.
So, and I quit my job. I did this full time.
Teach me your ways.
Let me tell you. I originally quit my job in 2015 to write full time. And Victoria Christopher Murray offered me an opportunity. She's been my mentor. She and Rashonda Tate Billingsley had started Brown Girls Books. She wanted a Christian imprint on their roster. And she said, hey, Rhonda, would you acquire and edit books for me for this imprint? And I was really excited. I said, oh, wow, that's great. I'll do that. So I had already made a decision. I had a year plan to quit my job. Literally had an app on my phone that ticked down the days. But I had worked for the state of Georgia for, I don't know, 15 years, 16 years. You know, I was a single mom. And like I said, I'm going to quit my job. So Victoria contacted me, offered me this opportunity. I accepted it. I edited probably 5 books that were released, really good books that I was very, very proud of over the course of about a little over a year. And then I decided, I'm not trying to work with authors in this way. Authors are a handful. And I even thought about myself in some of my ways, you know, with my previous editor when I was at Urban. I was like, oh, girl, you was a mess and this is a mess. And this is not what I want to do. And so, but by.
Oh,
you was a mess and this is a mess. And I'm going to let other people.
And we are not going to be a mess together.
And so so Victoria was like, fine, she's a big purpose person. And so she released me from that responsibility and I decided to go back to work. Now, mind you, I had prayed for probably 4 years to quit my job. I got tired one Saturday night and picked up the phone on Monday and said, called my old boss and said, I'd like to come back. Not a prayer, not a thought, not a conversation. Boom, I'm going back to work. I got back and it was so horrible. It had gotten so much worse. It was like, God, it put so much trouble on that situation. This is not what you're supposed to be doing. And I could not stay at all. And so finally in 2018, I left again. And I've been out since 2018. We're all gaining weight. Everybody's, all the bills are paid. My credit isn't tore down. I'm making it happen.
And yes, ma'am.
I'm making it happen. And so I've written literally during the pandemic, I mean, at the end of 2020, I wrote a story about, surprisingly, a romance novel that was just supposed to be a Christmas story that's turned into a 9-book series. I've written 9 books in that series since.
The Bennett series, right?
The Bennett series since December of 2020. Yes. So it's just like I said, I've got great readers. I think I work hard. Turn out the work, do the writing, you know, and respect what people want from you. I was really surprised that people wanted the Bennetts from me. Again, it goes back to that initial surprise when breaking all the rules. Like, oh, y'all want a romance from me? It was like, oh, y'all want this kind of romance from me? It was like, yeah, girl, we trying to escape. This is this here pandemic. Give me all the escapism literature. That's what people wanted. And I gave it to him. But then, like I said, I got, you know, during that, I also was like, oh, I want to write serious books, too. I can give you this over here, but I hope you'll follow me over here, too. You know, and so in you know, here comes the thing about home.
What were you writing before you delved all the way into romance and went indie with it? When you talk about serious books,
I was writing stories about women who were in crisis. A lot of stories about marriage and couples and people trying to survive marital difficulties. And so when I turned that off, you know, it became all about, okay, let's write about love. Let's write about people falling in love. And readers went there. They enjoyed it. So I continued to write it. And it was paying the bills.
Amen. And so the thing about home is actually a mix of those two things. There is the crisis of relationships and marriages, and also the breezy love story that I think people have come to know and love you for that pays the bills. So yeah. What was it about this book at the time that you started looking for an agent and getting back into traditional publishing that you said, you know, this is the one that I don't want to do it on my own anymore. I want the support of the industry.
I felt like Casey's story was special. And I'll say this, I sold it as a contemporary novel. There was no historical story. It was just in the present. And Odessa showed up one day at 2 a.m. in my dreams and said, hey, I've got a story to tell. And I thought, seriously, I'm going to write historical. I'm going to do dual timeline. Lord have mercy. That was not in my wheelhouse.
When the ancestors show up, they get loud. Honey,
they get very loud. They get so loud. They get so loud, and they have to be heard, and they have to be respected. And so, but that really stretched me. But I decided that I just thought that her story was bigger, had the potential to be bigger than anything I had written. And so I just decided it was just time. You know, some of my best friends had gone from being indie published to traditional published. Vanessa Riley, you know, who is amazing. And she's the person I text on a daily basis about this or that, you know. And one of her things was, Rhonda, it's time. Give it a try. And the only way you're going to get to the next level, you know, without doing all the work that you say you don't want to do is to come back in. Is to come back into being traditionally published. And so I pitched it at a couple of places, started looking for an agent, found an agent, got to deal with Thomas Nelson. And, you know, the rest is the beginning of a new history.
Yeah. So like that was 2020. And here we are 3 years later and the book is coming out.
Yeah.
Oh, I love your journey and your story so much. So let's get to the book and Casey Black's story. So if you would read a little something and then I can ask you all my questions.
Okay.
The Thing About Home opens with a 30-something social media influencer being jilted at the altar. After one drunken Instagram live, the model formerly known as Casey B flees the limelight for the South Carolina family of the father she never knew. What unfolds in the reunion is the restoration of her soul and the revelation of her purpose. Here's Rhonda.
So I'm going to start in the first chapter, but on the second page in the first chapter for the sake of time. And Casey is on her way to her vow renewal ceremony. She's been married to her husband, Drew, for 7 years. My phone buzzed. Expecting it to be Drew, I warmed a little around my heart. He hadn't texted or called me since early this morning. We weren't in new love, but I expected a little excitement and romance. The text was from my mother. Don't be late. As if, I whispered, deleting it. I was 36 years old, and I'd never been late to any meeting or event in my life. My mother's lectures on timeliness were repetitive and exhausting, yet effective. So I was grateful for her consistency. I swiped until I located my husband's number and tapped to dial. After two rings, it went to voicemail. He's busy. That's what I told myself. But a strange tension hovered in our home, one that I summarily dismissed as pre-renewal stress. But try as I might to ignore it, my intuition kept nagging in a familiar female voice, my own, that something was wrong. Or maybe it was that something was worse. Things had been off between Drew and I for a long time. But in 45 minutes, we declare our love, celebrate it, and then fix whatever might be broken under the warm Hawaiian sun. I raised the phone, twisted my face into that dumb duck lip, and captured my image, humming to the lyrics playing in my mind. I typed the caption, "I'm at the chapel and I'm going to get married." Minutes later, with the help of the driver, I eased out of the limo and joined my part of the wedding party, which included my maid of honor, cousin, bestie, Leslie Parker, and my former supermodel friends, Alexis and Reese, all but Swella, my assistant, who I treated to a black and crystal beaded Carolina Herrera suit, were wearing form-fitting off-the-shoulder silk sage dresses under faux fur shawls that matched the fur wrap keeping me warm. We looked beautiful. "Let's get a pic," Swella suggested, and the women I loved flanked me and posed with enthusiasm and bright smiles. Waving us toward the building, Swella led our small party through the packed parking lot. The cars were all empty. Everyone was inside. It hadn't snowed or rained as predicted. I silenced the annoying little voice again. It was a liar. Today was going to be perfect. 20 minutes later, the annoying little voice could no longer be ignored. This wasn't a wedding, but I told Drew I didn't want him to see me until the ceremony. So when he knocked on the door of the bridal suite and insisted I join him across the hall in the pastor's study, the hair stood up on the back of my neck. The heavy door closed with a thud that echoed in the corridor behind us. I waited a beat and then another as Drew stood there in his luxurious Giorgio Armani tuxedo, the tuxedo I picked out for him. Discomfort reddened his face. He looked away from me. When he returned his eyes, his expression was odd. So I steeled myself for what he had to say. "I can't go through with the ceremony." Drew's brittle words floated above me. They couldn't land in my brain, but I registered fear. It slammed into my back, splitting me in two. Casey, 90 seconds ago, and Casey, now.
Thank you. So I didn't know what to expect when I started the book. I just like kind of dove in. I was like, okay, this is good. It's breezy. It's good. It's breezy. And then I was like, oh, trauma. And I was like, whoa, I wasn't expecting that. And so it's a historical fiction novel. So there's that backstory that's in many Black folks' backstory, which is slavery. So there's mm-hmm. that and how that leads to the present day and how the family has come up from slavery, to borrow from Booker T. Washington. But then also there's Casey's own personal conflicts with her husband in her marriage and that she's having to reckon with. And making sure that you were telling both a serious story as you had in the past, but also keeping some of that breezy romance charm that you had developed with your readers through your indie work. How did you first conceive to braid these two together so that we became invested in the story of this woman on this journey to find herself and what really home was for her?
It happened, like you said, you know, the ancestors spoke. I originally intended to be sort of a woman rebuilding her life after a divorce and finding love with family that she had never known, meeting her relatives, being introduced to foods that she had never really eaten. Walking on ancestral land was going to be an experience for her that I hoped that I was going to be able to paint the pictures of with my words. But I also immediately, there was Nigel, you know, the hope for new love was always there. And so it was just sort of the magic of writing, because I'm an outliner. And so I had a fully fleshed out outline, you know, and of course, you're selling a book for the first time to a publishing house. You've got to have a synopsis. They're committing to the story that's on the paper. And I know that that can change somewhat, because clearly it did. You know, like I said, Odessa woke me up at 2 a.m. and I called my editor and said, "Hey, I need to talk to you. Like, I have this whole historical dual timeline thing happening. Are we going to be okay with this?" And she was like, "Do what you want, you know." And I love that answer from her. And so I think it just sort of happened organically. I did not set out to write this particular book, but this story showed up in my soul and in my spirit and screamed. Really, it was the voice of my family. You know, I love historical fiction. I've always enjoyed reading historical fiction. And one of the things that I've learned from reading historical fiction is, like, you know, it can be difficult when you read our history because there are lots of moments of pain associated with it. But there's also, I imagine, and I look at us as a people, we are always a people who celebrate. We're a people who love hard. We are people who love family. We are people of faith, no matter what that is. You know, we dream. And I had this vision in my mind that my ancestors, they had dreams and they had hopes and they had love. They had to have love. They produced us, you know. And I became invested in writing the story that I hoped for them. I wanted to imagine what I did not know because we didn't have the history passed down in terms of stories. You know, we weren't like Roots, you know, like there was nobody telling the stories. And so in getting the stories out of our people, my people is like pulling teeth, you know, and that's very common in our culture that people don't want to talk about different things that were painful. Or don't think it's important, you know, they're existing for today and moving forward, looking forward. And I very much wanted to look back and imagine that there was beauty. And so I created it.
You talk about ancestors having dreams. And this is very much a story steeped in the experiences of the women, Casey, mm-hmm. her mother, her grandmother, her great grandmother. And so in one of the dual timeline chapters on page 327, Odessa was telling one of her own daughters, "Please do the things I couldn't. The women before you could only dream, but I know they hoped for a better day for their daughters and all the women down their family line. Do me and them the honor of living your dreams so that our sacrifices will be seed that has fallen on good ground." Whew.
Yes.
With that type of foresight from an ancestor for the entire generational line, do you see not only Casey's experience in the book, but just women, Black women in general in the world, as, you know, being the manifestations of these dreams our ancestors had that maybe they didn't even know how to voice when they were living?
Absolutely. You know, and you know, one of the things that we owe them is to live those dreams. We owe them to live those dreams. And I listened to a keynote that the Beverly Jenkins delivered at the Black Ink Book Festival a couple of years ago. And at the time, I had my contract. It was new. And I had just started drafting the novel. And I was struggling with being intimidated by it and feeling like, oh, why did I get myself into this? I could be writing a Bennett story. I could be doing anything. Like, I was stressed. Okay, because I'm that writer. Every day I wake up and decide I need to get a regular job. Every single day. Every day. I don't miss a day. I don't even give Sunday a break. You know what I'm saying? And so Ms. Jenkins talked about how there were women in the 1800s, there were Black women. And we don't even have to go all the way back to the 1800s. We can go back to the 90s. We can talk about the present. There are Black women that are writing stories that can't get contracts. They can't get published. There were no contracts. It wasn't a matter of competing for a contract. There was no entry for us, you know. And so now there is. And I'm sitting here with this contract stressing. And what I need to do is I need to do what they couldn't do. I need to write the heck out of this book to the best of my ability, push it, and honor them with just acknowledging the fact that I have what they couldn't have. And some of them indie published things, they wrote things out, they did whatever they could do. But we stand on the shoulders of some powerful people. I know in my family, I have relatives that I have thought about as I've written this book. And there's one in particular, the novel that I'm working on now, which is going to be my 2024 book. One of the strongest women in my family, matriarch of our family that we lost, you know, almost 30 years ago. And it's just like, I want to write the heck out of her story. because I want to honor her strength and her commitment, her love. There was always love. And our mothers and our grandmothers and our aunts have always wanted better for us. And so I think it's just for me as a writer, I wanted to show that between the pages. I wanted to, it was very important for me with respect to Odessa, that she was an educated woman. And there are different ways to be educated, to have knowledge. But whether you had a traditional education or you just learned from life, our people have always been smart, smart enough to know how to navigate and survive and heal themselves. We always knew how to use what we had, and just the genius that sits behind me. You know what I'm saying? And I wanted to honor that so very much. So that's why I use the letters in the journals, because you know what? We wrote things down. We read books. We knew things. And sometimes I think that people, that we even get so caught up in thinking about how much pain there was that we don't remember that there was beauty, that there was writing, there was literature, there was music, there was food that was enjoyed. There were happy times. There were weddings. There was a lot of good. There had to be, or we wouldn't have survived. You don't survive generations without there being some joy somewhere and thrive, you know? And so I wanted to put that on paper. I wanted people to see that there was that love and purpose has always been a part of our DNA.
Amen. So your title of the book is The Thing About Home. And on page 266, Casey is having a conversation with Leslie, who you mentioned in the reading, who is her cousin / best friend. And Leslie says, "The thing about home is it's not a place. It's a feeling. Mm-hmm. What I'm seeing is that feeling has found you right where you are." What does home mean to you?
Home means exactly that to me. It's a space in your consciousness where you feel safe and where you feel loved and where you feel like you're growing and thriving and where you are accepted for who you are. Whatever your imperfections are, whatever your, you know, because Casey comes to them just not knowing anything. Child, she don't know nothing. She don't know about no farm. She didn't even know our history. She knows nothing. And it doesn't matter. They just love her for who she is and where she is in her life. And so that's home. Home is just where you feel safe and loved. And it doesn't have to come from other people. You know, being at home doesn't have to necessarily be a feeling that you get from other people. You can be home in your own skin. And that's about accepting yourself for who you are, loving yourself, loving your journey, and just working on staying healed, you know, because we got to stay healed. You don't just get healed and be healed. You got to be intentional about staying healed. We got to fight for our mind and our peace and our joy and our mental health. You got to fight for those things on a daily basis and be intentional about making sure you're going to hold on to them. That's home. You home when you feel that when you're okay at the end of the day with where you are and who you are.
So with all of that said, and the vast journey that you've had in getting this book here, what do you want readers to take from it once they get their hands on it?
Wow. So I want readers to know that people aren't always what they seem. First and foremost, I've had several people that have reviewed the book or read the book and thought, I didn't know if I wanted to read a book about a social media influencer. They so shallow. Here we go with another one of those stories. And she is not another one of those stories. Casey is much deeper. So I want them to not, hey, don't judge a book by the back cover or whatever, the first couple of lines on the back cover, you know. Don't judge anyone based on what they do. You know, what we do isn't always who we are, you know. And I also want people to walk away with the history. That was really important to me. Not trying to educate, but I am. Okay, South Carolina was a different kind of state. And, you know, I've even had a reviewer who's an educator who said she didn't know the things that she learned in my book. Just a Black educator in South Carolina, you know, because it's been not taught, squashed, covered up. Let's not know. Let's not believe all these Black men were sitting in these high political positions. You know, we don't want to talk about that. We want to act like that didn't happen. But it did, that they took their power in every way that they could. And so I want people to see that we are always people who are taking our power, who are taking the next step. And I want people to see that, that we are not victims. We've never been victims, you know. It was an institution. We went through a thing, a big thing. But we still were people who, even within it, we created systems and ways to thrive and survive. And I want people to see that. I want them to see that Black magic.
There's a Black for that.
There's a Black for that.
I love that so much. It makes so much sense even more now when you, because in the book, that's the last name. So it's like a little joke. But even in like the real world and like thinking about Black people, there's a Black for that.
There's a Black for that.
I love that so much. All right. So speed round and game. What is your favorite book?
My favorite book is Your Blues Ain't Like Mine by B.B. Moore Campbell. And that's a fictionalized retelling of Emmett Till lynching.
Mm. Who is your favorite author?
B.B. Moore Campbell. She's gone. I miss her voice.
What is your favorite song?
Optimistic by the Sounds of Blackness.
Hmm. So I know you're based in South Carolina now, and this is a very much a South Carolina novel. So what is your favorite gullah dish?
Seafood broil. Boil. Seafood boil. Seafood boil.
That's not one dish. That's many.
That's many dishes.
That's many. Okay. If money were no object, where would you go? What would you do? And where would you live?
Oh, if money was no object, I would slow travel across the continent. I got a whole list of countries that I want to visit, and I would visit them for months at a time and just sit in the culture of each country, observe the differences between the cultures, learn the food. Just guess I'd be living over there with my laptop. If the money was no object, maybe I'd still be writing while I was there. Maybe I would just be enjoying life. I don't know. But that's what I would do if money was no object.
If your book got the movie adaptation, who would play Casey and Nigel? Because he fine.
Casey? And my first thought is maybe Dawana Wise or Andrea Bordeaux.
I can see Dawana.
And Nigel? Wise. Yes. You can see her, right?
I can see that.
And Nigel, you know, Aldis Hodge.
Yes. Ooh.
Yes. Yes, Lord. Right.
That's.
Yes.
That's beautiful.
Yes, it is.
What is your favorite book to movie adaptation?
You know, for a long time, it was The Pursuit of Happiness by Chris Gardner. Because mm-hmm. Will and Jayden killed it. But more recently, I really enjoyed From Scratch by Tim Bielak. It was a Netflix special.
And I did watch From Scratch.
You know, but I still, you know, I love The Pursuit of Happiness. I always love a story about purpose. So it still might be it, but I really love From Scratch too. So I've cheated. I've given two answers.
No worries.
I'm a cheater.
Name three things on your bucket list.
You know, I like to call my bucket list my someday list. You know, I ain't thinking about kicking the bucket. I got a someday list. So going to Ghana is high on that list. And that needs to happen next year. I really want to visit Victoria Falls and see the beaches of Sierra Leone. And what else is on my list? It's all travel related. But I'd also love to write a screenplay. I'd love to learn to write a screenplay and sell a screenplay. So I mean, because there's no point in me writing one if I'm not going to sell it. So that's on my list. And there's some really private things on my list. So I'll leave it with those two.
Okay. What brings you joy?
Food.
That's a great answer. I love food.
I'm just
I love to eat. And what brings you peace?
Private time with God. And that has nothing to do with church. That's just me and him talking, my journal, prayer, reflecting, figuring it all out.
And what dreams do you have for your future generations?
Oh, wow. That they would, my sons and their children would figure out what they were put on this earth to do. And they would do it with intention and excellence.
Amen. So our game is called Rewriting the Classics. Name one book you wished you would have written.
Trying to Sleep in the Bed You Made by Virginia DeBerry and Donna Grant. Because I've read it like 3 times and I rarely read a book more than once.
Name one book where you want to change the ending and how would you do it?
A Lesson Before Dying by Ernest Gaines.
Jay Gaines, yep.
You know, I did not want him to die. I just wanted him to live. I just wanted him to live. I wanted him to have an opportunity to live. And if I could rewrite that book, I don't know how I would have changed that masterpiece. I guess I would have turned it into a romance, honey. If
yeah, because I just think about the ending. The guy at the center, he's executed.
Mm-hmm.
And
he's executed.
He tells the teacher, tell her I walked. And that just breaks my heart. Tell her I walked.
Yeah.
Whoo. I got chills now.
I mean, beautiful novel. I have no right wanting to change the ending, but I don't care. I want it. I want life for him.
Yeah.
I want life for all of us.
All right. And so my little messy question, name a book that you think is overrated and why, or you could say it's overtaught. I'll let you soften it.
Oh, wow. God, I'm the do not finish queen. So I don't read books that I don't think are worth it. But do I even have an answer for this? I can tell you a book that I did not finish because I didn't. And this is blasphemy. Okay. Somebody might come for me. I did not like Pleasure by Toni Morrison.
Paradise.
That book. It was a really complicated story. And she initially, even in being interviewed, said, I'll never forget this. And she said, read the first chapter. And if you don't get it, read it again.
And that's the book that starts, they kill the white girl first.
I know, but.
That's some people's favorite book just because of that one line.
Yeah. I don't know.
All right. So my final question for you today. Well, you're dead and gone and among the ancestors. What would you like someone to write about you and the legacy of words and work that you left behind?
I would like people to remember and say that I encouraged them. You know, my goal as a writer, I think, is to touch the heart of women. Women are, you know, generally my audience. And I want Black people, Black women in particular, to be healed, you know, to forgive themselves and others, you know, because it's not a cliche that forgiveness is for you. And forgiveness is not about offering an olive leaf to somebody who has done you trash, you know?
Yeah.
That's not what it's about. It's personal. It's about your own heart. And so I write a lot of my books have a theme of forgiveness in them because I think it's so important. And it's not always easy, but that's what I want for people. I want people to take away a sense that there is peace in being healed and in forgiving. There's a wholeness there. You can access it. It's okay. It's okay to forgive somebody and move on. And they don't even have to know you forgave them. That's for you. You are at the center of that.
Yeah.
That's it. That's what I do.
Thank you, Rhonda.
Thank you.
Big thank you to Rhonda McKnight for being here today on Black and Published. Make sure you check out Rhonda's latest novel, The Thing About Home. Out now from Thomas Nelson. And if you're not following Rhonda, follow her on the socials. She's at Rhonda McKnight on Twitter and author Rhonda McKnight on Instagram. That's our show for the week. If you like this episode and want more Black and Published, head to our Instagram page. It's at Black and Published, and that's BLK and Published. There,
I've posted a bonus clip from my interview with Rhonda about how the changing social media algorithms influenced her decision to return to traditional publishing. Make sure you check it out and let me know what you think in the comments. I'll holler at y'all next week when our guest will be Nicole Cuffey, author of the novel Dances.
When I think of myself as a writer, I think of myself as a writer. I don't think of myself as a Black writer. At the same time, I am very aware that I am seen as a Black writer. And so I think there is this sort of balance between understanding myself as an artist and being really interested in honing my art and continuing to grow as an artist, but also understanding that my Blackness has a place and is in many ways central to my art.
That's next week on Black and Published. I'll talk to you then. Peace.